Today's show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef, available on the internet at HearstRanch.com.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Here, actually celebrating the 100th episode. Made it. Survived. With the lovely illustrator, Peter Arkell, who flew back from Scotland.
Yes, just a couple of days ago, so a little bit jet-lagged.
Excellent, and brought me a cookie.
Yes, so. It pays to turn up on radio shows with a cookie.
Excellent, and we'll eat that cookie a little bit later. But first, I wanted to say thank you for coming. I've admired your work for quite some time, seeing it in Food and Wine. I actually saw it in the soup kitchen on the Upper East Side.
I love that you saw those, because there's not even many of my close friends have even seen those.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a place you can just kind of go on tour visits all the time.
Yeah.
And it's not that near either.
But yeah.
I loved that job. I mean, it was just, you know, they really gave me free rein just to draw food, basically.
Yeah. What was that soup kitchen? What's the name of that soup kitchen?
It is called, the Yorkville Common Pantry.
That's the one.
I was struggling with the initials and what they meant, because I always just call it YCP. But
that's
fine.
We acronym a lot on this show when we forget.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it's an amazing place. I mean, they had a whole renovation paid for by the Robin Hood Foundation.
Yeah.
You know, they've been building libraries and things in schools and all kind of amazing things for New Yorkers. And I was approached by them, you know, via Pentagram.
Yeah. That's Michael.
They did the hard work. They had to do all the printing of my drawings and all the framing, which was a big job.
Yeah.
It was about, you know, hundreds of frames.
Oh, yeah. There were a ton of photos there. But it made what is usually such a drab and kind of sterile situation lively. And it showed. It reflected in the people that were actually.
Yeah. I mean, they wanted me to make it friendly and sort of a welcoming space.
Yeah.
So, I basically based it on the walls in my apartment. I mean, it was just trying to, because they have lots of little different size frames with different things in.
Yeah.
And I just thought, what would be kind of nice to do that? It'll make it look sort of friendly, you know. And the architects obviously worked hard on that too. Then I'm in that lucky position as the illustrator. I get to come along after all their hard work and all their planning nightmares and flooding problems and other things they had to go through. I come along and stick some drawings on it and get all the attention.
I'm sure it's a little more work than that.
Yeah, but you know, my job's often the easier.
Yeah.
The cherry on the top, you know.
Wonderful food pun for that. But your life, starting in Scotland, was it always visual? Was it always food?
It was always food. At the beginning, it was very basic. I mean, my mother, if she was here, would have to say that the only things I ate when I was a kid were rice pudding and what else? Oh, and fruit salad. So when, you know, whenever we went out, no matter how nice the restaurant, I would only want fruit salad or rice pudding. And I mean canned rice pudding.
Oh, yeah.
This stuff called ambrosia creamed rice, which all British people will know. Which I can still get a craving for if I'm really, you know, feeling ill or anything.
Well, it's a textural thing sometimes.
It's just, you know, and it's like really sweet and creamy and probably tastes of the can a little bit. It's delicious.
Do you sometimes cream and can your foods just to harken back to those days?
No. I'm just way not that much of a culinary expert.
Yeah. So in Scotland, where exactly did you grow up?
I grew up in a place called Pennycook, which is most of my life, which is 10 miles south of Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And then when I was, I guess I was 19, I moved to London to go to art school. I went to St. Martin's in the Royal College. And then in December 95, my girlfriend at that time got a job with Amnesty International and moved to New York, and I followed her.
Yeah.
And we broke up. I stayed. She's actually back now. We're still friends. She's actually French, in fact, from yeah. Paris. I just wanted to say that because she hates Paris, and I like to make her be French and yeah. from Paris. So if she's listening. so I've lived in New York now since December 95.
Yeah.
I love it here and did right from the beginning.
Yeah. So when you moved here, you know, we'll talk about your education and schooling in a bit, but what kind of regional cuisine did you leave behind? And was it easy to find here, or was it easy to also let go of that?
Well, you know, I left behind London food, but it's not really, it's beyond fair for me to try and sort of judge London food at that time, because, you know, I was either a starving student or a starving beginning illustrator when yeah. I lived in London. So I had very little money for eating out. It was kind of a big deal if I did that. You know, we'd maybe go out and have Indian food.
Yeah.
And there's amazing Indian food in London. Anywhere yeah. in Britain. I mean, you can, to be honest, you could be on the tiniest island in the remotest part of Scotland, and there's an amazing Indian restaurant there. It might not look amazing, but trust me, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's the perfect antidote to that awful, wet, damp, cold weather too. I will say, when I moved to New York, I kind of doubled in size immediately, because A, I had a bit more money, and then B, just food is bigger here.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's totally true. Like, I was completely skinny when I left yeah. London, you know, and grew.
Yeah. Are you still shocked by the size of food here?
Sometimes, yeah. I've sort of, you know, most of the places I eat regularly, I've figured out. So I know when you've got to share, when, you know, how to order so that it doesn't go wrong. Because I hate wasting food, and I hate that, you know, that thing when you have all of these dishes coming and you know you just can't eat them.
Yeah.
Just that depresses the hell out of me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can still, if I go and eat somewhere I haven't eaten before, I can sometimes get caught out. And my wife and I were just in Stockholm, and portions there are crazy.
They're almost medieval.
Everything is just giant.
Yeah.
And we never once made it to dessert. It's just impossible. Like, everything is just huge and rich.
Yeah.
And the thing that puts it perfectly into perspective is when we got back to Scotland after being in Sweden, we were really hungry. So we went to the local fish and chip shop and had like classic Scottish fish and chips, which is obviously not a light and healthy dish. But after eating that, which we wolfed down, we felt way less stuffed than we did after any of those like expensive Swedish meals.
It's yeah.
crazy. Like, so there's something, I don't know what it is, whether it's
like a reverse diet.
They love salt or whatever it yeah. is. It's something that makes it just so rich. Some
yeah.
really tasty food. I mean, and I love all of the things, the fish and everything they have there is fantastic.
Yeah.
It can get a bit giant.
It's so funny because looking at your work, you talk about large portion sizes. Some of that oddly reflects in how you draw single subjects, these kind of larger than life things from, well, potatoes, mm-hmm. Which I absolutely love. All the iterations of potatoes that you've drawn over the years.
Right.
How many have you actually drawn, and why were they lazy Sunday potatoes?
Well, I guess so much of my work involves endless detailed line drawing. And I love to cram as much information as possible into every drawing. You know, so often that a lot of art directors' job is, a lot of the time their job is to tell me, you know, just, you can cut that down a bit yeah. or simplify things. So after, basically, I wanted to get back into doing some painting. And I think actually the first potato painting I did was a Mother's Day gift from my mother-in-law. And I just was thinking, what will I paint? And I had this like little canvas ready, and I was like, what will I paint? And I think my wife said, why don't you just paint a potato? You love eating potatoes. You're always going on about potatoes. So, and it's, you know, potatoes are pretty easy to paint. You know, you need some yellow ochre paint, and then you can kind of slap it on. It's a little bit abstract. That's the thing I like drawing about. A lot of drawing food involves doing slightly sort of abstract things. It's like blobs of color. And,
yeah.
You know, you get away from line quite quickly. I mean, there's only really one or two lines in a potato. There's the outside of the potato, and then there's a few eyes here and there and a couple of dots, and the rest is all just like blobs of mushy color.
Yeah.
And then I just had this simple idea to stick it on a bright blue background, and it just looked so good that after doing that one for my mother-in-law, I then decided to start doing them every Sunday. I would just paint another potato. I would go out and buy one potato from the deli and take it home and immortalize it. And I guess in the end, I haven't done one for a while now. Probably done about 50 of them in total. I had an exhibition, probably 8 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And you know, I sold a bunch of them then. I kept, there's a grid of them in our living room, which is about, I think it's about 30 potatoes.
Yeah.
Something like, I can't even remember. You know, it's like five, maybe it's as many as 35 or something. I forget.
What did you make out of those potatoes, or were they just relics?
These were just purely painting. They were, you know, more than anything, they were to decorate my home. If I paint just for the sake of it, that's its main purpose. Occasionally I'll sell something like that, but yeah. They're really, as much as anything, it's because when I go and look at other people's work that I could buy, I will often cheekily sort of think, wow, I could do that myself. Why don't I do something like that for myself? So I'll sometimes do that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just it's a nice, why not have nice colorful pictures on the wall?
What does your apartment look like? Is it completely clad with paintings, drawings, it's illustrations?
Slightly less than it used to be, because we finally got around to having it painted by the landlord. And so we had to take everything down, and it's taking us a bit longer just to put things up. So it looks a bit more minimal than it used to, because basically as the walls got dirtier and dirtier, we just put up more and more pictures. So yeah. It used to just be completely thick with art, you know, just to hide all the weird stains and smudges on the white walls. And it's a weird apartment because it's quite small, and it's actually spread over four levels, but each level is only really like a sort of landing in a staircase. So you spend a lot, you know, if you're going up and down all those stairs, you brush against these lovely white walls all the time. So there's all these big smudges.
Yeah.
And it starts to look like some sort of serial killer's den, you know, with all these big like black handprints on the wall. And, you know, and also we used to both work from there as well. But now we rented the apartment next door, so we have our own separate workspace.
Yeah. So coming to New York in 95, you were a starving illustrator.
I was kind of a kept man illustrator.
Yeah.
I was personally starving, but my girlfriend was very nice and fed me.
Excellent.
So I can't quite claim the starving.
So in that transition, though, how did you start garnering work? How did you start finding clients and drawing what you wanted? Because it seems like you've done work that you really not only care about, but, you know, that you have this point of view that has been uncompromising and unfledgling.
Yeah. Well, the drawing, what I wanted to do was the easy part, because that's what I had to do to keep myself sane while I was waiting for employment, you know? So, well, you know, obviously I had part-time jobs. I worked in a coffee store in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I worked in London. I used to work in a picture.
Which one again?
In Leaf and Bean. Yeah. I believe it just shut down, which is sad. It's an old Park Slope institution run by really nice people, and I haven't spoken to them for a long time, but I'm very sad that it shut down now. But yeah, and they used to just sell hundreds of different types of coffee beans and lots of tea and coffee making utensils. It was kind of a fun first kind of part-time job in the city.
Yeah.
Taught me to be American a little bit.
Well, you also did a study of coffee beans while you were there, or coffee bean.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've always had a thing about coffee. It's, you know, who doesn't?
Yeah.
That just seems to be everyone's thing now. You know, coffee's just everywhere. I love how, you know, new coffee trends just spread so rapidly. I love this new flat white phenomenon where...
I don't know that.
Which came... You know, flat white is just basically a latte with less milk. And so it's just... It actually tastes more of coffee because, you know, a latte just tastes like a cup of hot milk. And
yeah.
You kind of want a nap afterwards.
Yeah.
So I think flat whites come from Australia originally. It's part of that Melbourne coffee culture.
Interesting.
And I've noticed in the last few months, those are spreading everywhere.
Yeah. Well, I'm holding in my hands to a project that you did, in London in the Royal Academy of Arts? Or
Royal College of Art,
Royal College of Arts, all about coffee.
Actually, that even goes before that. That was back in St. Martin. Sorry, I'm being confused. But yeah, basically, whenever I would be traveling or bored, and I stop and have a cup of coffee, I would find myself making little drawings of the cup of coffee in my sketchbook. And... you know, my teachers at school were always saying, well, you know, you've got all these fun little drawings and doodles in your sketchbooks. You need to take some of them out and do something with them. And so the very first idea I had of doing that was to just go through the notebooks and collect all of the drawings of coffee cups together and put them into one little limited edition, photocopied at that time and stapled little book. And so that just became called Coffee. And it's just literally a collection of 60-odd drawings of cups of coffee. You know, they're not just drawings. There's little notes next to the drawings with saying something about what I was thinking or who I was with or where I was when I was doing it. Sometimes there's just a comment about the cup of coffee.
Like vomit, puke coffee.
Yes, exactly. And that became a good way for me to make a lot of my personal work. I would, you know, just you know, I'm always doodling in my little notebooks. And I'd just now and again go through and just find some subject or some things that worked well together. Obviously, there were a lot of observations of weird things I would see on the underground in London or the subway in New York.
Yeah.
Or just people in the street or whatever. And I, you know, I started collecting those together and editing them. And that became this thing called Peter Arkell News, which is my own little newspaper. Also, I began publishing that back at the Royal College.
Yeah.
First issue came out in 1993. Originally it was just photocopied. It's now actually printed on newsprint. And so, you know, now it actually looks the way it was always meant to, because it was kind of meant to be a tabloid newspaper about everyday life.
Yeah.
With sort of tabloid style headlines. But, you know, instead of being about celebrity scandals, they'd just be about a weird shape at the bottom of my coffee cup or whatever weird little thing I come across.
Yeah, or your travels in Moscow.
Yeah, well, that's the most recent issue, and that's a crazy one. I mean, I was approached by Snob Magazine, which is published in Moscow. They just literally gave me this complete dream commission. They said, we'll pay you to come over to Moscow, and all you've got to do is hang out and make a newspaper about it. So you can do whatever you want. You know, you can... you know, just be a tourist, basically. And I said, are there specific things you need? And they said, no, just, you know, have fun. And we'll, there are some English-speaking guys at the magazine. They'll take you out and you can have some adventures with them. Because obviously I don't speak any Russian.
Yeah.
So that helped a lot. So, and the original idea was that they were going to publish that in an issue of their magazine. And they ended up just never getting around to it. I think that they were a bit daunted by the amount of handwriting they were going to have to turn into Russian handwriting.
Oh yeah, translation.
Which they were actually going to pay me to do as well. You know, I think they'd translate it all, and then I would carefully handwrite all the Cyrillic characters, which was kind of daunting to me as well.
Yeah.
So they ended up not publishing it, but they paid me in full and paid for my whole trip. And so I have this lovely issue where I just got sent to Moscow randomly. You know, and basically there's a lot of the stories are, you know, there's literally me sitting in a really nice restaurant in Moscow. Having a strange dessert. I think there was this one place called Coffee Mania, which had these crazy desserts.
Yeah.
They had names like the Fifth Element. And I think the Fifth Element was this kind of cake, like a ball of chocolate with, I think it had like gorgonzola and chocolate inside it. And it was actually delicious. And, you know, I would just look at this display cabinet of these cakes, and my original aim was that I would just go there every night, and the whole newspaper would just be, each day of the newspaper would be the name of one of those desserts.
Yeah.
But I ended up getting distracted and doing some other things.
Yeah.
Including going to the steam bath with one of the editors of the magazine. And we were naked and like hitting each other with branches, which I've never done with a client
before. Yeah, I don't know if I see that in this magazine.
There's no drawing, but no. There's a description of it.
Yeah. Well, it also seems that you figure out you have a weak bladder, or it's a lot of drinking and peeing,
yeah, well,
it seems.
November in Moscow is very damp and cold, and I did spend a lot of time like rushing around trying to find a bathroom.
Yeah,
that's just my problem.
Well, what's awesome about this being not only a travelogue is how almost myopic you get, how and I don't mean single subject, but that you narrow it down on a very specific point of view, and you know, fastidiously and obsessively draw about that thing.
Right.
How do you approach subjects?
I think I mainly I start by sort of panicking. If someone gives me a subject to think about, you know, my first thing is, oh my god, I need to learn everything possible, and I try and cram everything in, and that. You know, so I'll just start with the first thing in front of me, then I'll try and develop on that, and I'll learn more and more and more. And, you know, it's basically like a crazy collecting process. I just try and jam in as much information as I can. And then I sort of sit down, and whether it's like drawings or notes or photos, whatever I have, and then it's a matter of sort of editing from that, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the first thing I do is often something really, really complicated. And that comes from a kind of an urge to satisfy the client, to show them, especially if they're paying for my time. It depends how the fee is and all of that. If they're paying me by the hour or something, then I want to show them that I can really deliver for the money they're paying.
Yeah.
So I try and baffle them with something really complicated. And then once I've got that down, that'll sort of give me the confidence to actually do some more fun, often more simple ideas, you know, which are actually the things that people often end up going with. You know, so... sometimes I wonder if I could make my life a lot easier by just
just doing this simple
thinking
thing
quietly. Like, you know, maybe I should just go somewhere and sit and have a quiet cup of coffee and then just do one simple drawing. And I'd probably get away with it in a lot of cases, but I'm just not that kind of person. I have to sort of like go all psycho and eventually I'll get to a very
exhaust everything
thing.
And then find what's right.
So, you know, a lot of things I work on, I'll have all these piles of like ideas and things, and then at the end there's one little drawing, you know, which took 2 minutes.
Yeah,
but I probably couldn't have got there without having to go through all that stuff first.
Yeah, exactly,
you know? And the notebook is you know, that the kind of writing in the notebook is a bit of therapy in a way. When I'm sort of freaking out, you know, I can sit down and calmly, because I feel like if I can just sit still and go, I am drinking a glass of wine. The glass is an unusual kind of shape, and the person at the table behind me is saying this weird thing. Then it's already, there's this little focus thing happens. And of course, like, it would be really boring, I think, if all I did was go inward into that kind of level. But then getting a grasp of stuff and information like that at that level sometimes then allows me to come across something much more amazing.
Yeah.
You know, because once you focus down like that, that's when you realize and you start to spot like weird little coincidences.
Yeah.
Things that you may not have noticed otherwise.
Yeah. That's where you kind of set your foci.
Yeah. I mean, I was actually early to get here, and I was sitting outside in a coffee shop along the street on a little wooden bench in the sun. And I'd just written the word something about Swedish people in my notebook. I was just remembering something about the recent trip to Sweden, and literally two Swedish people walked by, and it was just like, really?
Do you feel like sometimes
amazing,
you control the world with your mind?
I wish. Yes.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about this cookie, which I'm about to eat, and a little bit about scotch.
Excellent.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back.
Shows brought to you by Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef, available on the internet at HearstRanch.com.
Shouldn't have started eating this cookie while we were coming back. Welcome back to The Food Scene. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Peter Arkel. Where did you get this cookie?
That cookie came from Babuki, which is the most amazing Greek bakery in Essex Street Market.
I'm going to have to second that
right
now.
Run by a lovely lady called Rona. And if I got her name wrong, I'm dead, but I'm pretty sure that's her name.
But at least this episode will live on forever.
Yes, yes.
Well, yeah, this is a delicious cookie.
Yeah, she makes amazing stuff.
Yeah. Where else do you go about and eat in New York? Do you go to those places for sustenance or for subject matter?
I actually get really, really hungry, so there's no... My all creative skills shut down as soon as I get a bit hungry, so I purely go to eat.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, I literally just kind of lose it. You know, I have to eat, and then I feel a lot better.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's obviously being that hungry and desperate, a lot of my eating happens very locally. You know, we live on Avenue C in the East Village, and we'll stagger around the corner and go to supper quite a lot.
Yeah. That's of the little Frankie's Empire.
Exactly. Yeah. That place is just great. They have you know, a lot of that has to do with it being the place we go to a ton of times, so they know us in there now, and they make us feel very welcome. But I just love their simple food. I love how much amazing food they can make from that tiny little kitchen and how quickly. We tend to go at off times. It does, that place gets a bit too insane and busy at night and stuff during the, you know, later parts of the week. Go there on a Sunday night, Monday night, earlier in the week. Go there for brunch at the weekend. Great.
Yeah.
I'm big fans of the Brooklyn Taqueria, which is also an Essex market. That's been amazing.
Yeah.
I had lunch there today, in fact. And it's kind of like this light, tasty, delicious thing. I come out of there just feeling totally happy.
So do you ever crave Scottish cuisine? Do you ever look for it in the city?
No. Occasionally I'll get... The cravings I get are for things that are sort of more mass-produced, like particular types of cookie and things. And if I want the sort of more... What I think of as Scottish cuisine is quite simple, and it's more like the sort of home cooking I grew up with. So I tend to just make something myself, and it will inevitably involve potatoes. If you go out in Scotland, a lot of it's this sort of pub food, and you end up getting a lot of like really starchy, crazy, heavy food. They do love to serve dishes which include mashed potatoes and French fries, which can be a bit much.
Yeah.
But it's funny, I think actually... there's amazing produce in Scotland, but a lot of restaurants there mess it up by trying to be too complicated. And if they just grill it or do it really simply, it would be amazing stuff.
Yeah.
And that seems to be, I don't know, I think there are some, there's a thing called Cullen Skink, which is I think it's a smoked haddock soup. And that is a delicious thing, which I think you can get that at Highlands here sometimes, or at Mary Queen of Scots.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had it there, but I believe it shows up on their menu.
I thought it was just interesting what you said about Scottish cuisine, if they just kept it simple. It's almost like what you were just talking about prior to showing your client this very complex piece of work, and really it could be as simple as a painting of a potato that impresses them the most.
Right.
Yeah, it's sometimes you don't understand the inherent ability of the product skill. Yeah.
And I think the reason for that complexity is a very similar thing. It's the same sort of money-based reason, you know, because basically the restaurants, and you know, it costs more to eat out in the UK. It's,
yeah.
You know, it's definitely, you know, just like it's literally cheaper to eat out here. And so it's something that people do as a more common kind of thing. And when you eat out in the UK, it's just more of a big deal, you know. I don't know by what amount, but it's definitely more of a big deal. So I think that the chefs feel they have to like do this fancy thing.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of goes all wrong.
Yeah.
They're pretending to be French, or there's this weird cream sauce, or you just, you know, and you're like, just can you just give me that delicious piece of locally caught salmon?
Yeah.
With those amazing like Scottish raspberries. Even now there are raspberries and strawberries which are grown in Scotland in the rain, in the dark, which for some reason taste completely amazing. I don't know what it is, what they do to them. But they've got they've just bred special fruit that likes those rainy conditions.
Yeah.
But oh my god.
Yeah. Well, let's get off the hunger because I want you to be able to focus on the rest of the interview. Tools of the trade. You were a pen and paper guy, I'm assuming, for years. How has it changed going from analog to digital?
It's kind of a slow process. I mean, it wasn't a big jump. I mean, all my work still starts in the same way. I have basically a Rotring art pen. It's just a basic black ink fountain pen with a fine nib, which I use for just about everything. Sometimes, you know, it tends to be on just the cheapest piece of photocopy paper. I buy packs of that. I draw something, and then if it's not quite right, I will trace it on my light box and make it right. And then when it's, you know, at a level where I'm kind of done with the twiddling about with the actual pen, I'll scan it into Photoshop and make some corrections and add color maybe. Or maybe if it's a crowd scene involving like 50 people or something, I might have drawn 50 individual people and I'll, you know, carefully cut them out and layer them all. And a lot of this is just because I know the kind of edits I'm going to face from magazine art directors.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to say, oh, that person over there, can you remove them or whatever? And it's just so easy, just with one click, they're gone. You
yeah.
know? And then, you know, obviously when it's all flattened and everything, it looks like a very nice, complicated drawing.
So are you more obsessive now than you were?
I think so, just because of the level of detail that you can get. You know, and zooming in on Photoshop can be kind of crazy. You know, I will end up drawing like a little pattern on like a coffee cup, which is in the background of a drawing, you know, and then I realize when I zoom back out that it's so tiny that by the time it's reproduced in a magazine, you know, maybe even at fairly low quality, whatever print quality, it's going to just not even be visible.
Yeah.
or the same thing, I'll be coloring something and I'm carefully, I realize I'm actually coloring individual pixels. I'm just like, what am I doing? This is not needed.
You know? Yeah. Well, then zooming out, in your newsletter, which I have in hand, is printed, like you said, on newsprint. How do people tactilely get that? Sometimes it's sold at Printed Matter here.
Yeah. I mean, they might still have some there. You know, it basically the main amount of them are just I send out in a mailing list. I have a list of subscribers which is continually growing, probably about 500 or something now. Yeah. I don't know. And they're all over the world. I mean, I have, you know, literally I have people. I have a lot in Moscow since doing that Moscow issue. I have subscribers in Australia. You name it, kind of everywhere.
Yeah.
I did even have one at one point who was in Antarctica at the McMurdo Sound Research Station.
Oh, that's awesome.
I think she's not there anymore.
Yeah.
Because the last issue I sent got returned. So it was fun to have her for a while.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the main way you get it is you drop me an email and say you'd like it.
Yeah.
And then you give me your mailing address and I send it to you. You know, I basically, it comes out so infrequently. It's about a year since the last issue. There's usually at least that much time between issues. I just can't, it's not a commercial thing. I used to charge people a subscription fee, but it just got ridiculous. So yeah. Now I just write it all off. It's a promotional thing.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's something I do. It does get me more work, so it genuinely does have a promotional purpose, but it's just a fun, you know, something to entertain people with.
Yeah. Really. Did this help you get the Anok job? Anok is the Scotch whiskey.
Yeah, I think... yeah, I mean, it was part of why I got that job. They originally discovered some of the work I'd done for Bumble and Bumble.
Oh, yeah.
I believe that they were literally just Googling Scottish artist New York. And that popped up. And they were like, he seems Scottish and seems like an artist we like. So they emailed me. And I, you know, I actually literally just said to some students a couple of months actually before that my dream job would be to do drawings on a whiskey bottle.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe this email saying, you know, we're representing this single malt. We'd like some drawings. And, you know, so obviously I had to pretend to be all blasé and reply, you know, say, yeah, I think I can possibly fit that in, you know, while I was, of course, going, yes.
Yeah.
Awesome job. You know?
So are you a big Scotch drinker on top of that?
Over the last like 10 years, I've become more and more of a Scotch drinker for sure. It is something I enjoy a lot. And there's just such a lot of great whiskies out there, a lot of different variety. I guess in the summer in New York, it gets so sweaty. I tend to move over to being more of a bourbon drinker.
Yeah.
On the rocks, perhaps. But
we won't, you know, tell Anna
whiskey
that,
yeah, they know that.
Yeah.
But whiskey, you know, whiskey is just so perfect for the Scottish climate. And the bit of the New York year that seems like Scottish climate, colder even,
yeah,
but less damp. But
there's a video associated. Well, first, how do you spell Anok so everyone knows?
A N C N O C, I think.
N O C.
And I bet I got that wrong.
Yeah, just Google it. But go to Peter Arkell; you can find it there. But there's a video associated with the work that you did designing the bottle for Anok, which is lovely. And I think
that's just at anok.com.
yeah,
you can see the whole project.
Does that exemplify Scotland to you? I mean, in my mind, the pristine light quality, the kind of airiness, the seriousness, but at the same time the enjoyment in the land and the product was all there.
Yeah, I mean, well, they did a really good job in the video of they obviously had a lot of fun jumping between Anok, this Knock, which is this tiny little town in Aberdeenshire, in the way north of Scotland, with them, and of course with the East Village in New York. So they enjoyed that contrast.
Mm-hmm.
Anok is they always describe themselves as being like a modern tradition of single malt. You know, their aim is to sort of they're very traditional the way it's made. You know, I don't think they even use any computers in their distillery. It's all just calculators held on to weird old wooden desks with bits of masking tape and
pens on chalices.
Yeah, and just like, you know, it's a wonderful hands-on distillery. I believe it can actually all be run by one person. It used to be that they had to have two people to run it, and they came up with this amazing technological discovery that what they had to do was to cut a door into a wall, and that now allows one person to run the whole distillery, which is lovely, I think. And that kind of sums it all up.
Yeah.
You know, and they spend a lot of time sponsoring different arts and galleries and things in Scotland. So, you know, it makes, you know, they this is something that made sense to them to get an artist involved and do some limited edition bottles.
So you toured the distillery. Mm-hmm. You saw all its components, its the behind the scenes, inner workings. And I love all the illustrations you did of pipes, of tubes, of mm-hmm. you know, the infrastructure. What else kind of stood out at Annock to you prior to the final label being printed?
Yeah, the weather. The weather and the stillness. Like, it, you know, I spent a lot of time in the warehouse where actually all the work is officially done by that stage. I mean, the whiskey is just sitting in barrels aging, and it's just this amazing dark, almost like religious, well, spiritual space, shall we say. And it's just like completely dark, and there are all of these casks of varying ages covered in dust and a bit of mold and cobwebs and stuff, all just stretching off into the distance. And there's this nice silence, you know, spiders spinning their webs, there's the sound of the rain dripping. And it's just this, there's some sort of sense of magic, you know, like, because this is, you've seen them all bustling around and all the different processes that go on in making the whiskey. And then it's just this calm thing. It just sits there for years. And I remember as a kid, I would be really freaked out by the fact, you know, when the first time I ever saw a whiskey that was something like probably only 10 years old, but, you know, as a little kid, 10 years is just like forever.
It's a lifetime.
And I would just be like, really? So the whiskey sits there for 10 years. You know, and of course, some whiskeys sit there a lot longer than that, but that just freaked me out. And so being in that room with all of these aging barrels was just amazing.
Yeah. So you arrived at a final, you know, label for Annock.
Yeah, I mean, I sent them a lot of different ideas, and the final choice was what, you know, something they went for, which is I'd drawn little symbols for all of the ingredients of the whiskey. You know, all the things that you can see, the things that are actually really in there. You know, the malted barley, the water, the heat that you use, the yeast, which is used in the process, and of course, time. And then I realized that I needed to add one other thing, which was magic.
Yeah.
So that's where there's this like extra mystical thing. That's what makes Annock Annock.
Yeah, the sixth element.
Yes.
Yeah, no gorgonzola in this one.
Yes, no gorgonzola.
Just patience. So you're obviously a Scotch drinker, now having your face plastered over how many cases, how many bottles?
Yeah, it's like a little cartoon version of me. They actually, when I was at the distillery, they had an empty cask and they asked me to paint my face on it, which I did on camera. And then that little quick cartoony version of me became something they included on all of the packaging, which is fun.
Yeah.
But it's very much a cartoon me.
Yeah.
You can tell it's me, I guess.
I can tell it's you. The Manhattan Cocktail Classic is coming up in mid-May.
Yeah, on the 13th of May, Sunday the 13th.
So the stateside premiere of Annock.
This is, it's actually, they're having an event called a Taste of Scotland on, I guess it's in the afternoon, on the Sunday the 13th, at Highlands Gastropub in the West Village. And there's a lot of things that are involved in that. A lot of other, I think there's even some other single malts that are going to be there. But part of that is that Annock are launching the American version of the limited edition bottle that I did.
Pretty awesome.
Which is should be fun.
Yeah. Mashed potatoes and french fries.
Yeah, there's food, there's a lot of drink, and it should be a very nice afternoon.
Excellent. Peter, thank you again. I'm going to start sending you potatoes in the mail to re-engage you into painting.
That would be, I've never been asked to paint someone else's potato. That could be, I've done people's dogs and babies, but yeah, no potatoes.
And that is that the oddest, pervious thing I've ever said on air. So thank you for that again.
Excellent.
And
I
for the cookie. And how do you say it? Sláinte?
That'll do.
Yeah. How do you say cheers in Scottish?
You can say, there's a really long version which I don't like, which is slangiva, but yep. There's also, I think there's slanty. Yeah, which I, you know, Scottish people out there are probably cringing because,
yeah,
you know, I've become so American that I probably can't even say that properly anymore.
Well, slanty to you.
Cheers.
100th episode of the Food Scene, heritageradionetwork.com. Hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Michael Harlan Tickell, bidding adieu.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.